I'm Jonathan Capehart. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. President Trump and members of his administration have dismissed, disparaged, and attacked the investigations into Russian interference with last year's election. Some argue that the president has sought to obstruct justice. Mistakes by some journalists have further muddied the issue. In the current issue of The New Yorker, Jeffrey Toobin looks at Michael Flynn's recent guilty plea and how the Trump administration is responding. His article appears in The New Yorker's print edition with the headline, "The Russia Portfolio." Online, the headline is, "Michael Flynn's guilty plea sends Donald Trump's lawyers scrambling." You can find a link on our show page, and I'm very pleased it brings Jeffrey Toobin back to the show. But the first time
we're together. Well, you're an MSNBC guy, so I'm a CNN guy. So
that's
we'll never see each other.
Never. But I mean, you're in my living room. It seems every morning.
Well,
talking about this stuff. So, all right. Now, last Wednesday, a large majority of Democrats in the House of Representatives joined Republicans in defeating an attempt to impeach President Trump. What's been offered as justification for impeachment?
Well, I really think that is highly premature. And I think there is widespread loathing for the president for all sorts of reasons, perhaps justified, perhaps not. But in the realm of high crimes and misdemeanors, I think the current evidence is well short of it. But there is a serious investigation underway by Robert Mueller and his staff. And there is certainly suggestive evidence of potential high crimes and misdemeanors that may yet be found. But I do think that effort was a significant jumping of the gun.
So high crimes and misdemeanors. So we had sort of a tutorial in that back in the late 90s
yes.
about what constitutes high crimes and misdemeanors. And it's whatever Congress wants it to mean, isn't it? That's not a legal statute.
Well,
it is
in the Constitution, so it does have the force of constitutional law.
But the Constitution doesn't define
it. It doesn't define it, but it doesn't define any of its terms. It doesn't define freedom of speech. But what's different about high crimes and misdemeanors is that the definition is solely under the jurisdiction of the House of Representatives and the Senate. It is not something that can have judicial review. Freedom of speech and of the press, the First Amendment has been defined hundreds of times by the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has always said, and I think correctly, that this power to impeach is solely at the discretion of the House of Representatives, and they can define it. And you know, it is much more a political act than a legal act.
And that's it.
It is a
political definition, and it all depends on who's in charge of the House of Representatives, who's in the majority of the House, and who is in the White House that determines how actively the House decides to pursue high crimes and misdemeanor.
And you know, the two impeachments of our lifetime, the Richard Nixon, the House of Representatives never got to it because he resigned, but both under when Nixon was president and when Clinton was president, you had the House of Representatives under the political control of the opposition party. And I don't think you can overstate how significant that is, particularly today when the parties are so even more polarized than they were in the 90s or the 70s. You know, I'm sure we all remember Donald Trump saying during the campaign, "My supporters are so loyal, I could stand on Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody." I think the vast majority of Republicans in the House of Representatives are so loyal that Robert Mueller could say whatever, and this Republican House would never even move to investigate Trump for impeachment, much less impeach him. Mm-hmm. But you know, it is a changing political situation, and many people think the Democrats will retake the House next November, and then impeachment could really become a realistic possibility.
Well, let's stick to this point of Republicans, like, no matter what, you know, they're the folks on Fifth Avenue watching this happen and not doing anything about it. In the grand scheme of things, what does that do in terms of the institutions? Doesn't something like that, where Republicans are clearly watching something happen that, say, had Hillary Clinton done it, they would have been all over it in terms of impeachment. Doesn't that erode the trust and confidence of the American people in the institution of Congress, the legislative branch, the executive branch?
I think it does, but I think, you know, what, and I say this as a student of the Supreme Court, but also of politics, you know, the biggest political development of my lifetime has been the evolution of the Republican Party. The Republican Party has become a much more conservative, much more a partisan in a political body than it used to be. There used to be a very significant number of moderate and liberal Republicans in the House of Representatives, in the Senate, on the Supreme Court, and they're all gone. I mean, they are really all gone. You can make an argument about Susan Collins in the Senate, but, you know, in the 70s, you had in the 70s and 80s, you had people like Arlen Specter and Robert Packwood and Mark Hatfield and Chuck Percy and Robert Stafford and John Chafee. I mean, this was a very significant part of the Republican Party. They're all gone. And now you have a situation where someone who is widely acknowledged to be a child molester has substantial institutional support, Roy Moore, in this Alabama Senate race, something that I think would be inconceivable even 10, 15 years ago.
Oh, inconceivable even 5 years ago.
Well, I don't know when the moment changed, but I do think that, you know, you have a Republican Party today that is just so much more right-wing than it used to be, that they are willing to support someone like Roy Moore. And, you know, relatedly, they are unalterably opposed to any sort of impeachment investigation, no matter what Mueller finds.
Right. And we should also mention that, you know, President Trump has his own allegations out there against him in terms of sexual assault, misconduct, and harassment.
But I think that's related, that the idea that someone like Donald Trump could become the nominee of the Republican Party with his personal baggage and his patterns of behavior is another sign of how much the party has changed.
So let's get into Michael Flynn and the guilty plea, and just how does the Flynn guilty plea impact the investigations that are happening on the Hill? How many investigations do we have underway altogether?
You mean the congressional investigations?
Yes.
Well, to varying degrees of seriousness, you have I would say the most serious, which is the Senate Intelligence Committee, chaired by Richard Burr of North Carolina. Mark Warner is the ranking Democrat
from Virginia.
From Virginia, they are, I think, doing a serious investigation. You have the somewhat more comic House Intelligence Committee, where it's not even clear which Republican is in charge.
I was going to say, is it Nunes? Is he still?
Well,
or is it Gowdy?
Well, no. Gowdy is Judiciary. Gowdy is still a different committee.
All right.
I'm blanking on the guy's name who sort of took over when Nunes went a little too bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a deeply partisan and not terribly functional investigation. Then both the Senate and House Judiciary Committees are doing some kinds of investigation. But I think the long and short of it is we are not going to learn a great deal from any of these congressional investigations, in part because of the pervasive partisanship. I think the Senate Intelligence Committee, though most of it is secret at this point, will, you know, disclose some things, but it's pretty much a Mueller or nothing scenario here.
Do they have to defer those congressional investigations? Do they have to defer to Mueller and his investigation?
Well, this is a question that has great personal resonance for me, because when I was a very young lawyer, when I was right out of law school, I worked on the Iran-Contra investigation. And I worked for Lawrence Walsh, who was the independent counsel investigating that. And as many people may recall, there was a investigation of Iran-Contra by Congress as well. And Congress gave immunity to Oliver North, among others. We, as prosecutors, prosecuted Oliver North, and his conviction was ultimately overturned because his immunity was judged by the courts to extend so broadly that the conviction couldn't stand. As a result of that, congressional committees have by and large refrained from giving immunity to potential targets of criminal investigations. And that's been true here as well. But that's not a rule. That's not a law. Congressional committees, if they are so inclined, can give immunity to targets of special prosecutors. They haven't done it here. I don't think there is any likelihood that they're going to do it, but there's nothing that's stopping them from doing it. It's just a matter of prudential concerns as coming out of largely the Iran-Contra case.
Okay, because I was about to say, it wouldn't be prudent for them to give immunity to someone while the bigger investigation is going on.
But that's exactly what happened in Iran-Contra.
Well, right, yeah. But they learned the lesson.
They did. I think they've by and large learned the lesson.
Well, Congress has learned a lesson.
Okay. How about that?
So, Michael Flynn's guilty plea, what exactly did he plead guilty to?
Something very straightforward and very narrow. He pleaded guilty to, on January 24th, 2017, 4 days after the inauguration, he was interviewed by the FBI. And as he admitted in his guilty plea, he lied about his contacts with the Russian ambassador to the United States. And he pleaded guilty to one count of making a false statement to the FBI.
And there are a lot of people who think, wait, this guy was national security advisor. He pleads guilty to one count. That must mean this is right. The scuttle here.
Sure.
This must mean that there are a whole lot of other more serious counts that were pushed to the side, and because now he's pleaded guilty and he's cooperating.
Well, he is cooperating, and that's a very important point to make. That's why they call them plea bargains, is mm-hmm. that they're both sides get something. Mueller gets a guilty plea, and he gets cooperation from a very senior member of the Trump administration and Trump campaign. In return, Michael Flynn is not charged with potential other crimes he may have committed. He was also very much under investigation for his relationship and lobbying for Turkey in the similar way that Paul Manafort and Rick Gates were indicted for their lobbying behavior in connection with Ukraine. So there is potential other exposure. What's unusual about Flynn's guilty plea is that it makes no mention of the other part of the investigation, and he has no immunity from potential further prosecutions if he's guilty of anything in connection with his lobbying activities. So this is, I think, another point of leverage that Mueller has over Flynn, that if he doesn't cooperate fully, he could potentially be charged with some other crimes, which is a very unusual way to do a plea bargain.
I mean, one of the things he meaning Flynn, stands accused of is plotting to grab someone living in the United States, a Turkish guy.
Gulen, the cleric.
The cleric, yeah. Who is the Erdogan government believes fomented the coup last summer, and send him back to Turkey.
Right. I mean, there have been news reports that he was somehow involved in this conspiracy to kidnap Gulen. I think it's important to say those are just news reports, and I don't know if that really happened. His lawyers have denied that he was involved in any such scheme, but certainly his involvement with lobbying and activities on behalf of the Turkish government while he was a leading member of the Trump campaign is at a minimum deeply bizarre, and potentially there were criminal mm-hmm. aspects to it.
Now, in the lead up to the announcement of Michael Flynn's guilty plea, there was a story that broke, I believe it's during Thanksgiving weekend, that the lawyers for Flynn and the president were no longer talking to each other, and that was everyone said, this is the sign that Flynn is cooperating with Mueller's investigation. The lawyers for Flynn and the lawyers for President Trump, what kinds of conversations were they having before this announcement was made?
Well, in complicated white-collar investigations, it is common for defense lawyers who represent people whose behavior is under scrutiny, you know, say an insider trading ring or some sort of securities fraud investigation, the lawyers for the various people who are being interviewed will have what's called a joint defense agreement. And sometimes it's in writing, sometimes it's more informal. And they will trade notes. You know, what are the prosecutors asking about? Who are they subpoenaing? What kind of documents are they getting? What kind of questions are witnesses being asked? There's nothing wrong with that. That's not inappropriate. It's perfectly appropriate defense behavior. But it is both customary and more or less legally required that if you, as a member, your client begins cooperating with the defense, I'm sorry, cooperating with the prosecution, you are obliged to withdraw from the joint defense agreement. And that's what happened right before Flynn pleaded guilty. And I think all of us who follow these things correctly guess that the reason he pulled out of the joint defense agreement was that he was preparing to plead guilty, as he did.
Now, the folks in the White House are like, it's not a big deal. It's, you know, we're fine. Everything is okay. But just from a legal perspective, no matter who the president of the United States is, something like that should be troubling to the West Wing. No,
I mean more than troubling. I mean, as the National Security Advisor is arguably in the top dozen most important jobs in the entire United States government. This is someone who has access to every bit of classified information that exists, who briefs the president every morning. He lied to the FBI on a day when he probably briefed the president that morning. And the fact that he was committing crimes while he had an office on the West Wing, steps away from the Oval Office, is an extraordinarily serious thing. Plus, he has agreed to cooperate and testify and give interviews and provide documents to the Mueller investigation. And no one has more information, as far as I can tell, about the inner workings of the campaign and the Trump White House than Michael Flynn. So the idea that this, you know, when George Papadopoulos pleaded guilty, you know, you could make a plausible case that he was just the coffee guy and he wasn't you could at least make that argument. You can't even conceivably make that argument about Michael Flynn. Michael Flynn was a deeply important figure. The White House should be very concerned about that.
I want to talk about the lawyers when we come back from this break. I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm speaking with Jeffrey Toobin, chief legal analyst for CNN and New Yorker staff writer, about his latest story for the magazine, The Russia Portfolio. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We'll be right back after a break. And we're back. I'm Jonathan Capehart. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. And seated across from me is Jeffrey Toobin, CNN legal analyst, staff writer for The New Yorker, and now his latest piece, The Russia Portfolio, or online at NewYorker.com. Michael Flynn's guilty plea sends Donald Trump's lawyers scrambling. And I want to talk about Donald Trump's lawyers. There are three of them, and I can't keep them apart.
It's an eclectic, interesting group.
Okay, so we've got Ty Cobb, John Dowd, and Jay Sekulow. Let's start with Ty Cobb.
Okay.
Who is he? What's he do?
Ty Cobb is different from the other two you mentioned, because Ty Cobb is actually a government employee. He has gone to work for the Trump administration. He is he works in the White House counsel's office, and his job is to basically serve as a liaison with the Mueller investigation. He is the person who has supervised the production of documents from the government, emails and whatnot. And he's a well-known white-collar crime lawyer with a firm in Washington. He's in his late 60s. He's been around a long time. He is apparently a distant relative of Ty Cobb the baseball player,
oh, okay.
Though they have the exact same name. And he he has had a very distinctive approach to this. His job. He is of the view that there is nothing here ultimately, and that the best way that the president can put this investigation behind him is to cooperate fully with Mueller, produce all the documents, and sort of kill the prosecutor with kindness, and that has more or less been the approach in the White House. We'll see whether it pays off and whether it's an accurate assessment of where the evidence leads.
Oh, that seems to kill him with kindness. But I mean, the president is not. I mean, how does the president factor into that approach?
Well, that's the Ty Cobb's challenge, is that he has a client who is not very well disposed towards towards Cobb's approach or kindness in general.
That he
loathes this investigation. He feels there's nothing to it. He said it over and over again. There was no collusion between his campaign and the Russians. It's all fake news, and he has not directly threatened to fire Mueller, but certainly everything you hear from the president suggests that the possibility exists, and certainly the news sources that he relies on the most, Fox News preeminently,
right,
has been talking endlessly about how the Mueller investigation is illegitimate, and more or less encouraging him to fire Mueller.
Right.
And that tension between what the president gets from his media diet and what he hears from Ty Cobb has yet to be resolved.
Okay, the next lawyer, John Dowd. Is he the one? He's the one with the handlebar mustache.
No, that's Ty Cobb.
That is Ty Cobb.
Ty Cobb has the very fancy handlebar mustache.
Okay,
yes.
So John Dowd is.
John Dowd is. A very experienced, which is to say old, lawyer in Washington who represents the president personally, the human being, not the institution of the president. He is probably best known to people who follow such things as the person who did Major League Baseball's investigation of Pete Rose for gambling on baseball. He was involved in the Iran-Contra investigation. He had a client there where I first got to know him. You know, a tough ex-Marine from Boston, a good friend of John Kelly, the chief of staff, who has a similar background. And he has remained mostly behind the scenes in the investigation and is not very used to or skilled at public advocacy.
And since he's the president's personal lawyer, is his office outside of the White House, or does he have a desk inside the White House?
Very much outside the White House.
Okay.
Yeah, he's a private lawyer, and Donald Trump, the human being, is his client. But unlike Ty Cobb, Dowd and Jay Sekulow, who's the other outside lawyer, they are very much outside the White House, independent actors.
Okay, and John Dowd is also known as the person who apparently claimed responsibility for the tweet that President Trump sent out that said Michael Flynn was fired, quote, because he lied to the vice president and the FBI.
Right, which was a seriously incriminating tweet if you unpack if it was taken literally. Because remember, right after Trump fired Flynn, he went to James Comey, then director of the FBI, and said, please go easy on Mike Flynn. Please don't be too tough on him. If that tweet is accurate, it means that Trump knew that that Flynn had lied to the FBI and then asked the FBI to go easy on him, which lays out a pretty clear case of obstruction of justice.
I was going to say, that's obstruction of justice. I'm no lawyer, but...
And if... that's why John Dowd felt compelled, I think, to sort of fall on his sword and say he wrote the tweet, because if Trump wrote it, that would certainly suggest at least the possibility that he was admitting to obstruction of justice.
But John Dowd then, by falling on the sword, puts his own career at risk, right?
Well, I'm not sure he puts his career at risk. He becomes a witness in the case. which could get him off of, which could get him thrown off the case as a lawyer, because it raises the question of, if you wrote the tweet, what was it based on, and what sort of information did you have? And that, since it does relate to obstruction of justice, could make him what's called a fact witness in the case and could get him off the case. And we'll see. It's one of the many threads that Mueller will have to follow.
Let's say he did do it. Is that unethical? Could that get him disbarred?
No. I don't think so. We're in the new realm of social media. Writing a tweet for your client, I don't think that's unethical. But it does raise the question of How did you get that information? Mm-hmm. And if you are making something public, as a tweet is, it wouldn't be covered by the attorney-client privilege. So that makes a that makes his role dicey, mm-hmm. to say the least.
Okay, you brought up attorney-client privilege, and I so want to ask you about the claim of privilege that Donald Trump Jr. But I have to ask you, since tweets, the White House says that tweets from the president are official statements from the White House. So knowing that, how does that color what you've just said about John Dowd?
Well, this is a question that Robert Mueller will certainly be asking and has every right to ask. And if I am Robert Mueller, I am going to seek to bring people before the grand jury to say, how do the president's tweets work? Who reviews them? Who writes them? Is there a review process? Does he write all of them? Does he review all of them? I mean, all mm-hmm. of those, if you know, I think all of us who know the president as a public speaker know that many of those tweets are very clearly in his voice. And he has said often that he writes his own tweets. But there are some that may be written by someone else. And this is something, given the importance of these tweets to the investigation, that Mueller will have every right to investigate.
Mm-hmm. The third lawyer, Jay Sekulow.
Sekulow, yes. Sekulow. Jay is the technical legal term is a piece of work. I've written about Jay a lot over the years. Jay was raised in a Jewish family in Long Island, and he went to Atlanta for college, and he had a religious awakening, and he joined the group Jews for Jesus. He went to law school and later became general counsel to Jews for Jesus. And Jews for Jesus, as I think many people know, is a messianic group that does a lot of aggressive proselytizing, leafleting and whatnot. And Jay had to defend Jews for Jesus in court a lot. And there, in that advocacy, he came to the attention of Pat Robertson, the minister,
the Liberty University,
conservative activist, religious figure. And they joined forces. Pat Robertson and Jay Sekulow joined forces to start something called the American Center for Law and Justice, which, as its acronym would suggest, is sort of a conservative counterpart to the ACLU.
Uh-huh.
Almost exactly the same initials. And Jay has been a very successful, actually, conservative religious litigator for a long time. He's had a lot of successful cases before the Supreme Court, but he's also become very much a public spokesman for the conservative cause. That's how he came to Donald Trump's attention as someone who's on cable TV a lot. And he has been hired as essentially the public voice of the defense. John Dowd doesn't do a lot of public advocacy. Jay goes on cable TV to say there's nothing here in this investigation, it's all fake news. So that's how his role is different from John Dowd's.
Don McGahn is the White House counsel. So if Ty Cobb is in the counsel's office and is the, you know, liaison with Mueller, where does Don McGahn just focus on the administration? He's not involved at all with the investigation.
Well, I wouldn't say he's not involved at all, but he has a broader portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
He deals extensively with the issue of judicial selection, you know, nominating judges to the Supreme Court and courts, you know, federal judgeships, something that this administration has done very aggressively and so far very successfully. That's in Don McGahn's jurisdiction. The White House counsel deals with a wide variety of cases. Ty Cobb is in the White House counsel's office, but his exclusive domain is as liaison with the Mueller investigation.
Got it. And we are running out of time, but there are two questions that I have to ask you about. Again, this attorney-client privilege thing that Don Jr. Invoked when he went to the Hill to talk to the, I believe it was the Senate investigation.
It was the House investigation. Yeah.
How is that even possible?
Well, you know, one of the things you learn in law school is that the attorney-client privilege only covers conversations between the attorney and client. And if anyone else is present, the conversation is no longer privileged. The idea that Donald Jr. could assert the attorney-client privilege in a conversation where lawyers happen to be present, where his father is also there and other people are also there, is absurd. But it goes to what we were discussing earlier, which is the only way a congressional committee can enforce frivolous invocations of the attorney-client privilege is threatening to hold the witness in contempt. Mm-hmm. Because you can assert anything you want if the committee's not going to punish you for it.
Well, right, and we're talking about a Republican-controlled committee, which clearly isn't going to do anything.
Exactly. So he could make this ridiculous invocation of the attorney-client privilege, knowing that the committee is not going to call him on it, which they did not. But that doesn't mean his invocation of the privilege is any less silly or frivolous.
And the fact that we know about this because of Congressman Adam Schiff,
right,
in an interview brought it up, to my mind, was a bit of message sending to everybody that while I can't talk about what happened in the meeting, I can talk about what didn't happen. And this was like a big red flag that he threw out there, an expression of frustration, but it was actually a big piece of information he gave us.
Absolutely.
Us meaning the American
well,
public.
And Schiff is the ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee and has become, you know, a very important public figure because he is the leading figure in that committee that actually wants to do an investigation.
Right.
Not essentially cover up whatever the Trump administration might have done.
And last question. President Trump and his lawyers have stressed all along there is no law against collusion. Why is that so important? And why shouldn't people be looking at all of this not as collusion, but conspiracy?
Well, I am going to leave this one as a cliffhanger because this is the core of my New Yorker piece about whether collusion can be a crime. I write several possibilities of how collusion could be a crime, but it is true that there is no crime on the books called collusion. But to examine that in depth, people are going to have to go to newyorker.com.
What a teaser.
How about that, huh?
That's great. I've been speaking with Jeffrey Toobin, chief legal analyst for CNN and New Yorker staff writer, about his latest story for the magazine, The Russia Portfolio. Jeff, thanks for being here.
All right, sure, Jonathan.